Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward. To start today, I'll continue reading The Reenchanted World on Finding Mystery in the Digital Age by Karl Ove Knausgård, translated from the Norwegian by Olivia Lasky and Damien Searles. When I left off last time, the author was in Greece interviewing the British author and artist James Bridal. Like I said, I've spent my whole life being utterly ignorant when it comes to technology, I said. I've just recently started getting interested in it, but I don't get it. I don't understand it. Your book, I was really astonished by it. So I thought you would be the right person to ask. What is computing? What is computing? James said, sounding a bit taken aback. I felt my face grow hot. It was like asking an author what a book is, or a director what movies do. Right, I said, the very basics. We take computing for granted, but if you went back 200 years and looked at what we're capable of now, it would seem like a miracle. What is it, really? It's just counting, James said. It's practical mathematics. Manipulating symbols to make representations of the world and then performing specific operations to change them. The example I always use for computing is the weather forecasts. You take a representation of something, for example, all the temperatures in Europe in all the different cities on one day, and then you do some kind of operation on them in order to understand them in a particular way or to project them forward. It's just about processing information and turning it into something else for a specific purpose, to predict or analyze something. It's a system for understanding the world. It's definitely not a mystery. Yeah, I see, I said, but if you're outside of it, then... But that, like everything else, is something that has been done consciously and unconsciously, is my feeling. It's been done deliberately by those who trade in it, to make themselves seem powerful, to protect corporate secrets, to be able to charge a lot of money for what they do, and so on. At the same time, the education system doesn't teach us ways of thinking that help us understand these things. But really, it's wildly accessible to everyone. It's a bit like if we were sitting here having a really complicated conversation about how to build this table. It would be easier to just build a table together instead. I think organic computers are one of the most fascinating topics in your book. Computers made out of crabs and ants and water. Perhaps especially interesting is what you write about Stafford Beer and his ideas. Who was he, really? He was part of the circle of people in the 50s and 60s, you know, when the idea of what computing was and what it could be was quite young and was in quite a lot of flux, who worked in the fields that kind of bled between neuroscience, psychology, particularly behaviorism and cybernetics. So yeah, Beer did all these weird experiments where he tried to harness natural systems in ways that would allow his computers to respond to the real world in some way. Digital computers are fundamentally disconnected from the world. They are operating entirely on the abstraction of it. They are being fed pictures of the world. It is like someone living in a box and knowing the world only through photos of it. It is two fundamentally different things. It is incredibly easy to manipulate and incredibly reductive. And therefore, what comes out is a reduced version of the world as well. Computers are fantastic for some tasks, but their cultural dominance is entirely misguided. They are fascinating, brilliant, and incredibly powerful, and infinitely interesting. But when they are plugged into large power and cultural systems, then strange things happen, and the violence it results in is really terrifying. Do you see a way out? Yeah, I mean, I'm not in the business of saving the world, but it would definitely be a better and more interesting place if more people were involved in making these things. That's the fundamental thing, that if more software, more buildings, more social spaces, and more everything were designed by more people, of course it would produce a more interesting and better world. Such an obvious remedy, but there are reasons why that's not how it is. One of Stafford Beer's most famous and brilliant phrases was POSIWID, which stands for the purpose of the system is what it does. It's a kind of maxim of cybernetics, and it's very good for diagnosing systems. Instead of saying, oh, we have a democratic system, we have an education system, you say, the purpose of the system is what it does. And what our society produces is people who are undereducated or just educated enough to perform specific tasks. The way to get a good education is to study something that has this high economic value. Apart from that, you are pretty fucked. The purpose of the system is to reproduce the existing power dynamics of that system again and again. That is what it does. Society has no interest in educating you in how technology works, because then you make your own technology, and you make different technology, and you upset the economic power balance and so forth. But it is doable, and people are doing it all the time. You can do it yourself. Do you do it? After I wrote my first book, New Dark Age, I became quite depressed. More than I realized at the time, probably. One way I got out of that depression was by making things. We bought a little van that I converted into a camper. I wanted to put solar panels on the roof, so I needed to figure out how to do that. And that was very specifically the start of a process that pulled me out of climate depression. I started making a lot of what I call solar toys, incredibly simple renewable energy devices. You build a box, you paint it black on the inside, you put a sheet of glass over it, you've got a solar oven. You can cook food in that if you point it at the sun. You put some light metal tubing inside that. You drill a hole in the top and in the bottom of it. If you put that in the sun, even in the middle of winter, cold air would go up in the bottom, hot air would come out at the top. You've made a heater. You can build wind turbines. I have built a few. I made one that charges my phone, ha ha. But that's not exactly the point. You can use them for more interesting things than that. I found that building these things moved me from a position of paralysis around the future to somewhere else, which is not to say that any of these things are going to save us. I understand that. But I built a sort of capacity to respond that I didn't have before. Before, my thing was that technology is big and scary and worrying. And one of the major problems with the Western world at the moment is that we live within the society of very large, complex systems that nobody really understands and everyone basically tries not to think about. That in itself is going to fuck you up. For years, I've been teaching people. I can do like a half-day seminar on programming or giving little tours of the physical structure of the internet. The seminar manifests it, concretizes it, and kind of puts handles on this big system so that it is no longer existentially terrifying. The weight you see lift off people when you do that is extraordinary. It transforms that from being this completely unknowable force that just acts on their lives into being a thing in their lives that they can see the edges of and conceptualize a little bit better. I call it technological literacy. For me, learning to code was what did that. A feeling of competence in the face of very complex systems. This is something that we just aren't taught. Generalized problem solving, inquisitiveness, or how to learn. My solar toys were therefore a revelation. You can do exactly the same with carpentry. We had long since finished the coffee, and I poured some of the water into the glasses. James sat with their forearms on the table, hands folded. The brick wall of the slanted building behind us shone white, and speckles of shadows played over the table when the wind swept through the foliage above us. The birds chirped. I said, "You can't compute the physical world, as you say. I think it is that mix of the physical world and the abstract nature of computers that made me so fascinated by your books. It is personal, you know. It feels like something is missing in my life. It feels a bit like I'm living in an abstraction, in an abstract reality." Every time you're not grounded in the world, you feel lost. It has been lost. The reason I write about this, and the reason it fascinates me, is because I really struggle with it, particularly to what extent it is okay for it to be just feeling, to not know it, and not to be able to justify it or prove it or point to it. I am part of my culture, and my culture is scientific, rational, and it is formed deliberately against what we think of as superstition or those other ways of knowing the world. The really good example of that in my book is the scientist I write about in Ways of Being, Monica Gagliano, who does the experiment with the plant memory. Yeah, and who also has this shamanic practice in which the plants tell her how to design these experiments. I really struggled with that, even though I have also spoken with those plant spirits. They exist. I have met them. It was one of the most terrifying, powerful, extraordinary experiences in my life, and yet my brain is constantly trying to tell me that it didn't happen. Can you tell me more about the experience? Yes, I took ayahuasca, an incredibly powerful hallucinogen. Most people who take it meet the goddess, the spirit behind it, and she is pretty frightening. And yeah, she gave me a vision. She gave me a lot of things. It was long, and it was very hard, and it was terrifying in many ways. It was also one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. The central vision that I had during this experience was a vision of the world in which plants were helping people. Really stunning. I literally saw a city with people moving around it and plants helping. Someone walking up steps and a vine kind of curling around them, and just this incredible strong message coming through of, like, we are here to help you. We want to help you. What am I supposed to do with that? Am I supposed to go read scientific papers to explain what I just experienced? I don't know how to write about it. I don't even know how to talk about it. I know how silly it sounds in language, right? But it is quite obvious that one of the problems with everything is that humanity largely has moved away from that relationship with the world. Really, really obvious. But how do we deal with it? One way is to come into the awareness that everything you think you know about the world is some kind of abstraction. I have no problem with the scientific method as a way of knowing the world, as long as you remember that it is only one way, and then can see it through another lens as well. Then it very much changes your relationship with the world. That is something I'm really struggling to articulate at the moment. Yeah? To actually hold multiple positions at once, which is really, really hard, and your brain doesn't like doing it very much. But what it ultimately does is return you to the world, because you see those things as being lenses rather than being the world. And suddenly you fall out of them and are in the world. It's like the illusion mysteries. There is no mystery to what happened there, but it is unsayable. It's two different things. The reason we are in the hopeless state we are in is that science doesn't believe that what is unsayable is real. After the interview, I joined James's family on a beach at the other side of the island. The sun had started to sink in the sky, which was heavy with light. The sea was dark blue, the sand was golden, the vegetation up on the hillside was a dull green. A huge yacht was moored in the bay, its hull gray, its windows black. As we swam out, James told me about new species of fish that had appeared here because of the climate crisis. The fish had come through the Suez Canal. The water was warm. The voices from the beach a murmur. I'd always thought that this was the eeriest time of day, as the day waned and night lay invisibly waiting. About an hour later, I took the ferry back to Athens, slept in a hotel under the Acropolis, which in the yellow floodlights seemed to hover in darkness over the city, and took a flight home to London early the next morning, while everything I had seen and heard out there on the Greek island slowly sank into the silt of memory, to be retrieved again intermittently in the months that followed. Autumn passed, winter followed. As I write this, it is spring, and the bulbs I planted in October have come up as flowers. They stand everywhere in the flower beds outside. The language of numbers can tell us how something works, but nothing about what something is. It must be experienced. In the ancient illusion cult, the initiates were led into a dark room where they were exposed to a whirlwind of impressions without anyone telling them what they were seeing or what it meant. But that was only half of the initiation. The next half took place the following year when they returned. Now they saw the initiation from the outside, and you could say that only then, when the gaze from within was complemented by the gaze from without, was the initiation completed. What conclusions they drew from it, what they learned and understood, was entirely up to them. But how to see the world from the outside when there is no longer an outside? That had been my question. The world was unpredictable, but all our systems were about predictability, which closed it off. James's thought is that we are surrounded by myriad forms of intelligence other than our own, forms that we have shut ourselves off from, and James's interest in organic computers and other experiments that attempt to introduce randomness into technological apparatuses came from a desire to open up the world. One of the reasons I liked James so much was for a way of thinking that did not exclude technology, did not designate it as the enemy, but rather, at least that's how it felt, placed hope in it. Where else could one place it? Where the danger is, also grows the saving power, as the German poet Hölderlin once wrote. The next piece I'll be reading is from the Harper's Archive and first appeared in July 1865. The Rail Splitter by Noah Brooks. The simple habits of Mr. Lincoln were so well known that it is a subject for surprise that watchful and malignant treason did not sooner take that precious life which he seemed to hold so lightly. He had an almost morbid dislike for an escort or guard, and daily exposed himself to the deadly aim of an assassin. A cavalry guard was once placed at the gates of the White House for a while, and he said, privately, that he worried until he got rid of it. On more than one occasion, the writer has gone through the streets of Washington at a late hour of the night with the president, without escort, or even the company of a servant, walking all the way, going and returning. Considering the many open and secret threats to take his life, it is not surprising that Mr. Lincoln had many thoughts about his coming to a sudden and violent end. He once said that he felt the force of the expression to take one's life in his hand, but that he would not like to face death suddenly. He said that he thought himself a great coward physically, and was sure that he should make a poor soldier, for unless there was something in the excitement of a battle, he was sure that he would drop his gun and run at the first symptom of danger. That was said sportively, and he added, "Moral cowardice is something which I think I never had." Shortly after the presidential election in 1864, he related an incident which I will try to put upon paper here, as nearly as possible, in his own words. It was just after my election in 1860, when the news had been coming in thick and fast all day, and there had been a great hurrah, boys, so that I was well tired out and went home to rest, throwing myself down on a lounge in my chamber. Opposite where I lay was a bureau with a swinging glass upon it. and here he got up and placed furniture to illustrate the position. And looking in that glass, I saw myself reflected nearly at full length. But my face, I noticed, had two separate and distinct images, the tip of the nose of one being about 3 inches from the tip of the other. I was a little bothered, perhaps startled, and got up and looked in the glass, but the illusion vanished. On lying down again, I saw it a second time, plainer if possible than before, and then I noticed that one of the faces was a little paler, say 5 shades, than the other. I got up and the thing melted away, and I went off and, in the excitement of the hour, forgot all about it, nearly, but not quite. For the thing would once in a while come up and give me a little pang, as though something uncomfortable had happened. When I went home, I told my wife about it, and a few days after I tried the experiment again, when, sure enough, the thing came again. But I never succeeded in bringing the ghost back after that, though I once tried very industriously to show it to my wife, who was worried about it somewhat. She thought it was a sign that I was to be elected to a second term of office, and that the paleness of one of the faces was an omen that I should not see life through the last term. The president, with his usual good sense, saw nothing in all this but an optical illusion, though the flavor of superstition, which hangs about every man's composition, made him wish that he had never seen it. But there are people who will now believe that this odd coincidence was a warning. From Personal Recollections of Abraham Lincoln, which appeared in the July 1865 issue of Harper's Magazine. The magazine's entire 175-year archive, including the complete texts from which these readings are drawn, is available online at harpers.org/archive. The next piece which I'll be reading is also from the Harper's Archive, Weltering Storm by Mark Twain. The Ausgleich is an adjustment, arrangement, settlement which holds Austria and Hungary together. It dates from 1867 and has to be renewed every 10 years. It establishes the share which Hungary must pay toward the expenses of the imperial government. The 10-year rearrangement was due a year ago, but failed to connect, at least completely. A year's compromise was arranged. A new arrangement must be effected. Otherwise, the two countries become separate entities. The galleries are crowded this particular evening, for word has gone about that the Ausgleich is before the house, that its president, David Ritter von Abrahamovich, has been throttling the rules, that the opposition are in an inflammable state in consequence, and that the night session is likely to be of an exciting sort. In his high place sits the president. He has sunk back in the depths of his armchair and has his chin down. He brings the ends of his spread fingers together in front of his breast and reflectively taps them together. He looks tired and maybe a trifle harassed. He is a gray-haired, long, slender man with a colorless, long face, which in repose suggests a death mask, but when not in repose is tossed and rippled by a turbulent smile which washes this way and that and is not easy to keep up with. A pious smile, a holy smile, a saintly smile, a deprecating smile, a beseeching and supplicating smile. And when it is at work, the large mouth opens and the flexible lips crumple and unfold and crumple again and move around in a genial and persuasive and angelic way and expose large glimpses of the teeth. And that interrupts the sacredness of the smile and gives it, momentarily, a mixed worldly and political and satanic cast. One half of the great Fano desks was in effect empty, vacant. In the other half, several hundred members were bunched and jammed together as solidly as the bristles in a brush, and they also were waiting and expecting. Presently, the chair delivered this utterance. Dr. Lesher has the floor. Yells from the left, counter yells from the right, explosions of yells from all sides at once, and all the air sawed and pawed and clawed and cloven by a writhing confusion of gesturing arms and hands. Out of the midst of this thunder and turmoil and tempest rose Dr. Otto Lesher, serene and collected. He began his 12-hour speech. At any rate, his lips could be seen to move, and that was evidence. On high sat the president, imploring order, with his long hands put together as in prayer, and his lips visibly but not hearably speaking. At intervals, he grasped his bell and swung it up and down with vigor, adding its keen clamor to the storm weltering there below. Dr. Lesher went on with his pantomime speech, contented, untroubled. At one point, a new and most effective noisemaker was pressed into service. Each desk has an extension, consisting of a removable board 18 inches long, 6 wide, and a half inch thick. A member pulled one of these out and began to belabor the top of his desk with it. Instantly, other members followed suit, and perhaps you can imagine the result. Of all conceivable rackets, it is the most ear-splitting, intolerable, and altogether fiendish. The persecuted president leaned back in his chair, closed his eyes, clasped his hands in his lap, and a look of pathetic resignation crept over his long face. It is the way a country schoolmaster used to look in days long past, when he had refused his school a holiday and it had risen against him in ill-mannered riot and violence and insurrection. Twice a motion to adjourn had been offered, a motion always in order in other houses, and doubtless so in this one also. The president refused to put these motions. By consequence, he was not in a pleasant place now, and was having a right hard time. Votes upon motions, whether carried or debated, could make endless delay and postpone the Ochsleich to next century. From Stirring Times in Austria, which appeared in the March 1898 issue of Harper's Magazine. Returning to the present, I'll read a poem titled Psalm 3 by Timmy Straw from A Work in Progress. You have kissed the wig, have stood between the window and its drapery, and looked out into the street like a spy at his assassin, like an assassin at his woman, like a woman at herself. You have brought your lunch up here to the very offices of time. From that escrow dark patches fall. They have fallen on me also. Beneath the planks of the conceit, the ground is very far. But you have kissed the wig, have fused the starry principle, have stood the plinth of finance from which angels crowd and watch the air happening gradually to them. Your boyhood home will hang like Absalom on air in Edom, where the air stirs harmless in the sealess dunes all the unpeopled months of principal time. This all Saul sang, did sing, Salah, and limping there, brackish to the very crotch and destitute. Drip, drip went the well. My hate has made me well. No person in between. You are listening to readings from the June 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Next up, Dan Pippenbring reviews new books. Harper's Magazine turns 175 this month, but this column, New Books, is only 23, too young to rent a car without incurring an additional fee. It feels older, doesn't it? Those two imperious monosyllables, unsullied by anything so profane as a subhead or search engine optimization, sounds as if they've always been there. Granted, today's column has its predecessors. The New Books, which sometimes dropped its article, ran from the late 30s to the late 60s and resembled the column we know today. Buried deeper in the archive, you'll find Among the New Books, which ran from 1924 to 1938. Its name makes the book sound like a secretive tribe infiltrated by an anthropologist. That's something of the spirit in which Guy Davenport, who wrote the inaugural New Books Reboot in August 2001, approached the assignment. He did seem to live among the books, writing with a mix of dégagé authority. All books on Kierkegaard are tedious, hence a metaphor. They create associations the way soap bubbles pack into cubes and hexagons, and outlandish anecdote. Davenport made his three chosen titles sing together in unlikely harmony. In his final column from November 2002, he reviewed a book about the science of affection and reminisced about a visit to B.F. Skinner's lab at Harvard. "What are all those white rats doing?" I asked, and was told that they were isolated and had been all their lives. They had never snuggled against their mothers or another rat. When the room was momentarily empty, I took a rat out of its cage, cuddled it, and may even have kissed it. The rat seemed overjoyed. When my sins and kindnesses are weighed by Osiris, I hope to see a white rat on the scales. All subsequent New Books columnists have aspired to their own white rat moments, to a criticism so curious and capacious that it can go anywhere. Of course we fall short. That's part of the job. "Being a columnist," writes one blowhard character in Chuang Zuteo's story collection, Hunter, Granta Magazine Editions, 1899, "forces me to think deeply rather than fob people off with the same cliched phrase, though I suppose you could say columns are kind of fake too." Yes, I suppose you could say that. Like Davenport's rat, Chuang's characters are shut-ins who could do with a good muzzle. They're struggling writers or fifth-rate actors who approach their professions with passing interest, invariably undercut by indifference or exhaustion. It's hard to muster enthusiasm when you're facing unemployment, ennui, aging parents, and the occasional brush with arson. Many of them live in S, a desolate city in China's deindustrialized northeast that, according to one character, resembles a completely bald head. This setting has defined Chuang's reputation. He is a laureled member of the Dongbei Renaissance, a cultural movement in China's languishing Rust Belt, as it's sometimes called, though that term feels narrowly Western. How much does a city like S resemble, say, Detroit? It may be that each unhappy former manufacturing hub is unhappy in its own way. Chuang's disaffected young men don't listen to Joe Rogan or stew seed oils. They play soccer or take up night fishing or murder. One narrator, explaining why he moved back to S, writes, "After getting a literature degree in Beijing, I realized that there was nowhere to go from there. Anything I did would involve living like an ant, forced to carry loads several times my body weight." Bodies, when Chuang describes them, are ill-proportioned and restive. At least four of his characters, in four separate stories, are called out for their short legs, as if they've been reduced by life's burdens. Three others walk, talk, or shadow box in their sleep. And when they've got to go, they've got to go. This is a collection in which nature calls with unnerving frequency. In Heart, a man accompanying his unconscious father on a long ambulance ride discreetly relieves himself on his dad's pee pad. The father awakes in a peremptory mood, "Help me get rid of this pee pad, it smells revolting," and promptly dies. In Up at Night, the narrator needs a pretext to search some tall grass where his friend has hidden a murder weapon. A leisurely piss is just the thing. And the title story follows a method actor stumped by his latest role, a rogue contract killer who starts gunning down public urinators. Dutifully, he memorizes such dialogue as, "You shouldn't be living like this. Build yourself a nice bathroom in your house and go enjoy it whenever you feel the urge to pee. Pass this habit on to your children." Maybe the men in Chuang's world are simply too well hydrated, or their power to let rip is one of the last they can freely exercise. or rampant public urination represents another snag in the threadbare social fabric. I don't know. In these stories, as one character says of feeling drunk, everything seems ridiculous, but also understandable. I enjoyed Schwang's sick, sad sense of humor and his left-turn endings. In Hunter, for instance, the movie about the assassin is abruptly canceled after the director drowns during an afternoon swim. The actor has wasted his days pretending to be a sniper, but he can't quite shake the role and winds up chasing a stranger with a knife. Occasionally, and to no apparent end, Schwang breaks with realism altogether. In Mars, a wax-sealed letter conceals a talking, slithering length of rope which strangles a woman. I sometimes felt like I was reading Jesus' Son with the drugs replaced by magical realism. Still, Schwang's prose, translated from the Chinese by Jeremy Tiang, is hypnotic and taut, and cultural differences aside, S is a familiar city, gutted by globalism, its blank-faced sleepwalkers at once idiosyncratic and instantly recognizable. Now everyone in the ambulance had their eyes shut, Schwang writes, and we entered a common darkness. Guy Davenport's first New Books column hailed Anthony Bailey as one of the most civilized of the old New Yorker writers, a phrase that it would never occur to me to use, but I'll trot it out for John Seabrook, who by now qualifies as an old New Yorker writer on staff since 93, and whose memoir, The Spinach King, The Rise and Fall of an American Dynasty, W.W. Norton, 3199, argues that his family was, if anything, excessively civilized. The Seabrooks, long of South Jersey, made their fortune selling vegetables, fresh and later frozen. They started with 58 acres and eventually had 50,000 under their control. By the end of the Second World War, their frozen lima beans accounted for 65% of the U.S. market. In the mid-50s, Seabrook Farms was the lifeblood of a company town in Cumberland County, with its own post office, water tower, and power plant. The corporation employed some 8,000 people. It brought veggies into the space age. Adopting a new polyester film developed by DuPont engineers, it packed frozen cream spinach in a Mylar miracle pack so you could boil it right in the bag. Every Seabrook Farms item came emblazoned with Seabrook's grandfather's signature and a guarantee. We grow our own, so we know it's good, and we freeze it right on the spot. In 1959, this motto also appeared on John Seabrook's birth announcement. I am shown emerging from a Peapod, he writes, a newborn brandling. Such is life when you've been sired by the Spinach King. Seabrook was, for a time, the heir apparent to a sort of feudal kingdom ruled by Seabrooks, to be passed down according to the law of primogeniture for the next 500 years. He lived regally, or rather, he watched his father, John, Jack M. Seabrook, Sr., live regally. From the 60s on, Seabrook, Pere, who was briefly the company's CEO and later chaired a utilities corporation, enjoyed a domestic staff of 12, including a butler and two stable boys, a cavernous wine cellar with a secret room inside another secret room, a stable of white Lipizzaners, and a carriage house in which he actually housed carriages, along with Pythons, Buckies, and Surreys. He practiced four-in-hand coaching and commissioned an oil portrait of himself with his left hand drooped languidly over his top hat, while his right hand grasped the whip and the calfskin driving gloves. Clothes make the man. Seabrook describes the Jolly Green Giant, his family's sworn enemy in the freezer aisle, as a bean-green Adonis sporting an off-the-shoulder Roman tunic of pea plants. By comparison, his father was a sleek mid-century fashion plate. Jack's wardrobe, mostly tailored by Seville Rose Bernard Wetherill, hung on a motorized carousel with a control panel. Jack could use the directional arrows to browse or punch in a three-digit code for a specific garment. A numerical key below the control box divided his clothes into 9 categories: dressing gowns, overcoats, country clothes, city clothes, odd jackets, odd trousers, formal evening wear, formal day wear, and odd waistcoats. Under each category were subcategories based on patterns, colors, and fabrics. Odd trousers, for example, were subdivided and labeled colorful, white, linen, gray flannel, tan, checkered, extra heavy, and corduroy. No amount of frozen lima beans could have paid those dry cleaning bills. Against his mother's advice, John Jr. dug into the family lore, unearthing all manner of fraudulence, enough to inspire this book. It turns out that Seabrook's grandfather Charles had run the farm with his father, ultimately cheating him out of his half of the partnership. In 1920, with the farm work increasingly automated, Charles became New Jersey's highway commissioner, enabling a lucrative 2-year phase of self-dealing. Later, he used his experience to bring in contracts for Philadelphia's celebration of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, eventually billing the city $9 million, a markup so gratuitous that he was permanently banned from bidding on Philly public works. To keep the party going, he went to the USSR to build roads for Stalin. But the asphalt he used couldn't hold up to the Moscow winter, and he went broke. Back on the farm, Charles suppressed wages and flouted child labor laws. As the Depression raged, he resorted to violent union-busting tactics, tear gas, blackjacks, pistol whips, fire hoses. He locked strikers in the company's freezer and recruited the local KKK chapter for additional security. Seabrook's Uncle Courtney once drove a truck into a picket line, sending a worker and 3 women to the hospital. In the 40s, Charles hired Japanese-American workers straight from internment camps, finding them less likely to defy him. Even for WASPs, the Seabrooks were waspish. Charles, as he grew infirm, yearned to annihilate his sons. Rather than see Jack take over the company, Charles sold it to complete strangers. In his will, he left Jack and his brothers a fraction of what they had expected. But John Jr. never could get his dad to open up about it. "You know, we Anglo-Saxons just don't do that," Jack said, describing his old man as merely a tough character. Jack was down, but not out. He kept 2 Swiss bank accounts, though it seems he used only one for money laundering. In the 70s, when the Wall Street Journal got wind of an SEC investigation into Jack's abuse of corporate perks, he promised, like one of Schwang's guys, to piss on the reporter's grave. The Spinach King contains a Mylar miracle pack of intrigue with everything you'd expect from a long-submerged, intergenerational, blue-blooded drama. Along with the succession battle, it's got phenobarbital addiction, involuntary commitment to a mental institution, boardroom humiliations, sexual predation, and a full century of functioning alcoholics. But its real business is the peculiar blood sport called filial love. Jack once taught little Johnny how to build a fire. Before lighting it, he sprinkled a few extra matches among the logs and told his son, "Pretend they're people." "I thought we were going to save them," Seabrook writes, "but we didn't. We watched as one by one their heads exploded into flame and their bodies shriveled and turned black." Such an apocalyptic vision may have greeted William Le Mesurier in July 1978, when he realized that the New York skyscraper he'd engineered, open to the public for less than 1 year and already bustling with tenants, had a 1 in 16 chance of collapsing during hurricane season. His must rank among the all-time most devastating spells of actuarial despair. Shame broke out on Le Mesurier like a rash. It occurred to him that he could drive into a bridge abutment at 100 miles per hour. Instead, feeling vanity, power, but almost joy too, he decided to confess to the mistake. In The Great Miscalculation, The Race to Save New York City's CityCorp Tower, New York University Press, 2795, Michael M. Greenberg goes into compendious detail about the debacle. Manhattan's CityCorp Tower at Lexington and 53rd Street was designed as a skyscraper for the people, whereas its contemporaries, the architect claimed, were only symbolic expressions of the machine. It seemed to rise from the earth on stilts like a hypertrophied beach house. To accommodate a long-standing church at its base, it was cantilevered on all four sides. Its top was slanted like the mouth of a whistle, and it distributed its weight through a latticework of braced chevrons along its 59 stories. The structure was so sleek and light that, to weigh it down, Le Messurier garnished it with a tuned mass damper, a 400-ton block of yellow concrete, skating on a thin bed of oil. CityCorp's first building manager would affectionately refer to it as that great block of cheese, Greenberg writes. It wasn't enough. The steel braces had been bolted instead of welded, and the engineers, following industry standards, had failed to account adequately for quartering winds, i.e., those that blow diagonally rather than head-on. Le Messurier discovered the problem only after a college student working on a paper called his office to ask why the tower's columns had been placed so unsafely. To avert the crisis, construction crews worked overnight welding steel plates onto the building's joints, their torches lighting up the skyline. This story will never become a movie because everyone remained calm, nothing fell over, and no one was evacuated or even sued. And yet what a story it is, girded by hubris and hope. Greenberg's writing is technical and never especially artful, but I was held in suspense. Then again, I thrilled to details about reinforced brackets and wind tunnel experiments. If a whole book feels like too much, check out the great article about Le Messurier that ran 30 years ago in The New Yorker. I hesitate to recommend a rival publication, but what the heck? I'm told they're celebrating an anniversary too. I'll conclude today with an essay titled Walking on Two Legs, Matthias Einar's Interrupted History by Nicholas Dames. Discussed in this essay, The Deserters by Matthias Einar, translated by Charlotte Mandel, New Directions, 192 pages, 1695. Matthias Einar's The Deserters, his 12th novel and 6th to be translated into English, bears some marks of its own interrupted composition with unusual vividness. Historical events broke it open like the burst of a shell. As Einar has described it, he had been working on a research-heavy project appropriate for quarantine isolation, a historical novel about an emblematic 20th century life. An East German mathematician, poet, and survivor of Buchenwald, whose idealistic loyalties and disappointments charted 60 years of European history, when, in February 2022, the 21st century intervened. The war in Ukraine, as Einar puts it, invaded his notebooks. It would leave in his project a datable trace, the way tree rings record catastrophes. The plan of the novel fractured, doubled. Now, alongside the fictional biography of his communist mathematician, Einar would have to add a wholly new element operating in a different register, one of up-to-the-minute urgency about war. The result, published in French as Désarté later that year, is full of stops and starts, with a post-impact jaggedness to its fragments. The question The Deserters raises, though, is less about what happened in Eastern Europe in 2022, to split the novel in two, that we know all too well, than how or even whether history ruptures. What is an interruption? A fissure revealing something that was always bubbling underneath? A switch of the rails to another timeline? A return to a prior state? An awakening from a dream? If The Deserters poses this question in a dramatic way, the relationship between change and continuity has long been Einar's preoccupation. Since his virtuosic 2008 novel Zone, a reflection on the recurrence of genocidal conflict in Europe from Nazism to the Bosnian War, and its echoes in an even more distant past, told in what is largely one several hundred page sentences, Inar has made his name as the writer most devotedly skeptical of the fantasy of a Pax Europea, most disappointed by the lie, because most beguiled by the possibility. Europe in Inar's fiction dissolves into vast, immemorial geographies like the basin of the Mediterranean, stretching from Algeciras to Beirut, with its coasts and enveloping arid hills, or the tight immigrant quarters of Entrepôt, linked in a continent-wide network of migration and capital flow, or the intellectual exchanges that cross linguistic and cultural boundaries. His work is suffused with such affection for the edge places where Europe bleeds into its others, Venice, Trieste, Alexandria, Algiers, that the continent becomes all edge. It caught the mood of the liberal cosmopolitanism of the century's first two decades, paralyzed as it was by the impasse in which the European project's utopian imagination seemed both insufficient for its success and in excess of what national governments would accept. In Inar's Arshenkin-era novels, his characters are always on the move, on flights, ferries, ships, and riverboats, and particularly on trains. These characters often belong to the set of people who either long to or are compelled to follow polyglot and transnational destinies, scholars, artists, refugees, and what all of these are often suspected of being, spies. In their border crossings, they have occasion to note the different ways Europe was once segmented into the lost kingdoms of the past. Al-Andalus, the Venetian Republic, and the Ottoman Empire, post-war occupation zones whose dividing lines over land or sea were erased long ago. Sometimes they dream of restoring those dispensations, if only to reconfigure their current world differently. Sometimes these dreams are nightmares of the atrocities once committed over those vanished boundaries. Charlotte Mandel has given English-speaking audiences Inar's two major works, first Zone, whose narrator, a French-born Croatian, merges his own past as a volunteer in Balkan combat with a history of violence unspooling backward from the operations of the SS to the Iliad. Then Compass, which narrates one insomniac night in the mind of a Viennese musicologist whose erotic yearning for an Orientalist scholar leads into countless microhistories of East-West contact, darkened by Mapolitanism by a double gesture, offering it greater imaginative amplitude while also correcting its tendency to imagine its own innocence. Look how many cultural paths you might take, his books suggest. How many ways to imagine human collectivity there are. And yet, look too at how often such paths have been pontoon bridges floating on currents of violence. How many artists and scholars and dreamers have allowed themselves to drift into complicity with oppressors. Inar himself, a Frenchman who became a scholar of Arabic and Persian, a resident of Barcelona sympathetic to Catalan independence, a poet and novelist, and even an owner of a Lebanese restaurant in Barcelona's Gràcia district, could be taken as an icon of post-national possibility, polylingual, polymathic, undeceived, but somehow still sanguine, neither fool nor fatalist. By 2015, when Compass won the Prix Goncourt, his fiction had been ratified as a resource for the embattled liberal consensus, dazed as it then was by shocks from the collision of the rising xenophobic right with the incidents of terrorist attacks in European capitals. Here was an artist committed to tugging that Europe into different, more recent fates of Damascus, Aleppo, and Baghdad. Although geographically constrained to Deux-Sèvres, the region where Inar was raised, the annual banquet of the Gravediggers Guild, translated by Frank Wynne, is built around a transpersonal kind of dream, reincarnation. The novel describes souls who, in the Wheel of Time, inhabit the Frankish king Clovis's horse, or a bedbug that fed on Napoleon. All these novels exalt an esoterica, daring the reader to open a web browser and follow up on a novel's anecdotes and curious historical divagations. They are also meant to release you from the constraints of territory and era and personal identity into alternative possibilities, sinuous lines of hidden connection. Propelling that release are a novel's almost interminable yet strikingly untangled sentences, long streams of thought pulsing only with the little hesitations of the comma, gathering in their current the exotic and the mundane, the distant and the proximate, as if moving to the rhythm of history itself. Europa, Enoch said with some creative precision when he accepted the Leipzig Book Award for European Understanding in 2017, was a Lebanese princess kidnapped on a beach near Saïda by a god from the north, Zeus, who desired her. It's a deeply characteristic remark, part hailing of a group identity and part challenge to that identity, meant to coax you out of political despair through the invocation of a mythic collective memory. It was his way, indirect and elusive, of situating the 60th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome in its moment, the moment of central bank enforced austerity measures causing mass unrest across southern Europe, of the Syrian Civil War, Britain's triggering of Article 50, and saying, understand, that northern god is still having his way. At its best, Enoch's fiction titrated consolation and warning, flattery and rebuke, so precisely that you might feel you could go on fighting the battle, even as you suspect you're losing it. Allons, enfants du continent. That is all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining me for this hour of readings from the June 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and hoping that you'll join me again next time.